This is the Afterbeat Podcast, episode 15, part 2, Dr. Tom Mason on Jazz Ed. If you haven't listened to episode 15, part 1, you probably should, but just to reintroduce Dr. Tom Mason, great saxophone player, great friend of mine over the years, and this is Rick Fleischman, did I mention that? Great friend of mine over the years and the founding chairman of the USC Thornton School of Jazz. Talking a lot about jazz education on the podcast through these last 14 episodes, I decided let's do an hour, and it turned into 2 hours, on Jazz Ed specifically, and Tom Mason's a great one to talk about that with because he's done all kinds of Jazz Ed in addition to being a great jazz saxophone player, lead alto with the Pat Longo Hollywood Big Band, and jazz arranger, composer, classical composer as well, just an all-around music guy. And we had a good discussion about Jazz Ed and also about Tom's career, about playing with Buddy Holly and all kinds of other stuff. So here is the Afterbeat Podcast, episode 15, part 2, Dr. Tom Mason on Jazz Ed. Enjoy. Wait a minute. Stop the music. We should remember that the first part ended with me commenting on the fact that now that musicians are able to control their own product, there's a lot of good stuff out there, but it's a double-edged sword because there's also a lot of bad stuff out there. And Tom agreed and then added his comment.
Well, yes, but you've also got to realize that there probably was something equivalent back 50 or 100 years ago. In other words, there was an enormous number of musicians who were wannabes.
Yeah.
And who were awfully good, who somehow got lost.
But there was less choice in the marketplace, too. It's equivalent to TV. I mean, when you and I were kids, there were four or five channels to watch.
Mm.
And back in when Louis was making records or whoever, you know, whatever period you want to freeze this at, there were a few big record labels and they put out by and large everything. And what you heard was what the record labels decided they wanted you to hear. You didn't hear some guy. I mean, for every Louis and Bix and everybody else, there were equivalent people in small towns who never got out of those towns.
Absolutely.
And never got heard.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean, God, the Montgomery brothers grew up in Indianapolis, not exactly a jazz, not a jazz mecca. How they got out of there is absolutely amazing.
Yes, it's a wonderful story.
And there's other people like them too. So it's interesting, you know. It's the whole world. That whole world has kind of changed around. And as a jazz educator, you have now the chance to reach people in a much more equal way, and give them more of a chance at being heard than you would have 30, 40 years ago. Because then it was a crapshoot. You know?
But the point is that there was always the fourth trumpet, the third alto, the third trombone, the backup rhythm section player in Django's band,
right,
who was an awfully nice person, probably had technique up the yin-yang, but somehow the spark of inspiration never got lit.
Yeah.
And so for those people, they've always been there. I don't see that as changing. I guess what we're saying is the details are changing.
Mm-hmm.
But is jazz going to be alive and well by the mid or end of the 20th century?
Well,
I think so.
So 21st. So there's another way into that. So what, as a jazz educator, what are you educating people to do? What's the end game for somebody who right now goes into USC as a freshman at Thornton and says, okay, I'm here for the whole program. I'm here for a master's, let's say. I'm here for 7 years, 6 years, whatever it takes.
Six.
What's the end game? What does that person have to look forward to in a perfect world, let's say?
Well, I think one of the things that that a school environment gives you is a living, breathing laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have other people of like mind, and you find them, if you don't, that you come in contact with on a regular basis, you rehearse with them, you share your fears and your aspirations, and you measure yourself in terms of, well, that's another person who plays the guitar, and he's an awful lot better than me. Am I going to get my technique together to a point where I can do that, or do I, you know, you're testing yourself. Mm-hmm. You've got a chance to do that. You're learning technology. Where when I was in school, I remember when Finale first came out, that was like, my God, why would anybody ever want to do that except to copy out big band arrangements?
It's so slow. What's the point?
So you have that. You have other kinds of technology. You have at SC, because there's a wonderful, very creative motion picture TV right literally across the street from us at various places. They're always looking for composers and arrangers and people to do background music, and they want a mashup of this, and they want something for that.
So it's a very immersive experience there. You can do all kinds of things. You can take advantage of all these things.
Yes, and you get you're in a kind of a pressure cooker, but it's a very stimulating environment. And I think that you know that you want to be a musician, but as to what kind of musician, that hasn't been quite scoped out yet. It's a great place to be.
Yeah.
Because it'll give you time to discover who you are, what is important in your life, what do you have to do to get there. You're going to have, like I said, you're going to have technology, you're going to have the business of music, you're going to learn about everything from how to write a contract that doesn't get you screwed, which is an important thing.
Yeah.
You're going to learn those things. Because you're in the school environment, you're constantly being kept abreast of the latest new developments. Mm-hmm. Where, let's say someone like yourself, Rick, you're out in the field, and new things, you'll hear about them at the NAMM show, and you'll hear about them maybe from one or two close friends who share interesting ideas with you. But on a day-to-day basis, new things may be happening that you aren't privy to for sometimes weeks or months. Mm-hmm. And the kids, literally, I imagine the first 2 weeks of the fall term, it's everybody kind of getting reconnected and finding out what happened during that three-month period when we were home with the folks vegetating.
Right.
So I think it's a healthy environment. It's a different kind of environment. The caliber of the students that we get, because we are very discriminating about who we admit, we get, you know, honestly, there are some students who are incredibly talented, but they aren't terribly gifted intellectually.
Like they're savants with their musicality.
Not quite that bad, but the point is they just they're not bright enough to be able to showcase and market and produce the product that is available through their talent. And all they do, you know, what they are is they're very good technicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I guess, what I was getting at, is you get these kids, because I saw this at MI when it was GIT, too. Mm-hmm. You get kids who can really play. I mean, who can already outplay you, you know, in terms of being able to actually execute, but there's nothing behind it. There's no reason to listen to them, you know. It's like building a very well-constructed brick wall, and there's nothing behind the wall, so there's no reason to ever look, you know, beyond the wall. That kind of thing kind of fascinates me. I just wonder where... That's why I said the original question, the way I framed it, is what's the end game? What when these kids come out in 6 years, what are they equipped for? Are they equipped for more academia to be teachers? Are they equipped for the professional world? What's that? We'll have another discussion about what that professional world going to be in a moment. But I mean, what do you see as being, you know, as being the end product?
Well, let's say that one thing is they will have a whole lot more tools than just what I had when I was coming out of school, which was either a desire to become a teacher or a desire to become a player. In other words, because of the training in technology and the training in new devices that are constantly being created, they're at a place in their lives where they can go in many directions. They have a certain flexibility that perhaps I didn't have when I graduated, because the training that I got essentially pointed me in one direction. I think that it's possible to play jazz or to play music which is in jazz-like or inspired what is jazz? It's improvisation in the moment in relation to what is going on around you.
Right.
And when you're around other musicians who share a common interest in that kind of phenomenon, things happen that don't happen when all you do is play the viola part to a Mozart symphony.
Well, that's a world in which it's prized to be able to do the same thing that somebody else did in more or less your way, but to play the same notes with more or less the same tone, with the same, you have this fealty to the printed page that as jazz musicians, we, after the first 24 bars, we abandon. We say, okay, we've got the theme stated. Now we have to go off and make a comment. We have to be someone that someone wants to listen to. It's not just enough to have the technique to execute. Someone has to want to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the classical world, especially if you're in an ensemble, that's not really what it's about. It's a real different set of skills. You know what I mean?
Well, I talk about it as the creative and the recreative experience.
That's a real good way of putting it, yeah.
Because you have, for example, you know, it even goes down to things like comedians. The storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Danny Thomas
is a recreative artist.
Yeah.
The person who just walks out on stage and hasn't got a clue as to what they're going to say until their mouth opens. And from then on, I'll see you in 45 minutes.
Yeah, Louis C.K., Marc Maron. Yeah.
Okay. For these people, in other words, there's a parallel there. The Broadway show or Shakespearean actor, as compared to the person who creates.
Hang on a second. I don't want to stop the machine, but I'll edit that out.
Whoa.
Can I let the dog in here because I'm recording?
Sorry about that. Go ahead. You're making a very interesting point. I want to pursue that.
Well,
so the Shakespearean actor does.
Except I don't hear myself now.
You don't?
No.
I hear you
no,
fine.
No, you pulled my cable. Is it possible?
Oh, did I pull your cable? I did. I pulled your cable clean out.
Okay.
Well, a pox on me for a lout, for a scurvy lout.
Ah, you're back.
Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Okay.
So the Shakespearean actor.
Well, the Shakespearean actor's job is to recreate, alas, poor Yorick.
Yeah.
You can interpret it any way, you know, unique to the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the lyric is there. It's given, and
right.
You and it has to happen at a certain point in time.
It's
and
a
it
text,
has to leave.
Yeah.
And so you have that versus the person who creates a character in a movie or on a live television show.
Mm-hmm.
Again, so in almost all the plastic arts, you're dealing with. The creative artist and the recreative artist. And in the jazz world, I think one of the most frustrating things for me, when I was, for example, at one point I was touring with Tex Beneke, playing the Glenn Miller book.
Right.
And we would play In the Mood, and Tex would play exactly what he played on the original recording from God knows.
That's why people came to see him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I said, do I have to play Al Klink's solo? And he says, no, for God's sake, no,
yeah,
don't. He
yeah.
says, don't, no. He says, play whatever you want. He said, I'm going to play this.
Right, right.
You know, and...
although, in a way, that does give you a kind of freedom because you know something that's going to take place and then you have to put your own comment on that.
Yeah, I know what cool. he's going to play next.
Right.
So, I did an album of mine called Deja Nu. And that was one of the first albums that a serious jazz musician was doing where he did all the parts.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in 1999. And on it, I played all the saxophone parts, and I had John Tramas play all the trumpet parts, and Ira Nepas played all the trombone parts. And what was fun was we would do these Count Basie arrangements, and I could play lead alto, and I could follow myself.
Yeah, that's nice.
which I thought was kind of ironic. But I did several pieces where I traded fours.
Mm-hmm.
And what an unusual mental thing that was for me, because I knew what I had played.
Yeah.
And now I know, you know, I'm not responding in the moment.
It takes a surprise out of it, yeah.
Yeah, and it what I found when I listened to the tracks, and it was all over, I was amazed by the fact that I pulled it off, and mm-hmm. it really sounded like two different people, which was in and of itself kind of interesting. But I sort of felt like there was some macro theme that was running through both solos that would never have been possible if they had truly been improvised in the moment.
Right, right. That's an interesting thing to happen, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. You know, you brought up comics. Comics, modern comics, have always likened themselves to improvisers, to jazz musicians. A lot mm-hmm. of comics will tell you what I do is just like jazz. When I meet comics, they say, oh, yeah, we're kind of doing the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. There is a similarity to it. But comics never, very seldom anyway, actually go out with no idea what they're going to say. A lot of comics today, modern comics, the text that they use is not, it's not like Danny Thomas, who would go out and tell this series of stories that always
Or Cosby, or
some of these people that mm-hmm. always had, you knew that they were getting to some sort of punchline. The text of their life, Louis C.K., people like this, is their life. The text of their act, rather, is their life. They'll go out and talk about something that happened to them or some episode in their life, and they'll find comedic observations in there, and they're really pulling it out from inside of them. And that's what you do when you're soloing as well, or that's what you're supposed to be doing. I teach that a solo is like a comment on a text. You're given, it's kind of like writing a book report about a book. And if someone told you to write a book report about Moby Dick, you wouldn't simply reproduce Moby Dick and hand that in. You need your observations on Moby Dick. You know, what does this mean? What happened? How does this affect you? And so if you're going to play a solo on Someday My Prince Will Come, you don't merely play back the melody. That may be part of your solo, but it's not what you do. You make a comment on the melody and the chord changes. That's what you're trying to do when you play a solo, or at least it's what I'm trying to do.
I think that's fair. I think we're often expected to bring our own take on things into our solos.
Yeah.
And again, to the person who thinks that all this is learning giant steps in 12 keys, mm-hmm. That person has never really confronted that issue.
Right. But, I mean, is it possible to get through a program like you have at Thornton and think that it's all about learning giant steps in 12 keys? I mean, it seems like somebody who, if that's all they took from it, they would have missed most of what was actually going on.
Well, let's put it this way. The most critical years of training at a university are the first two.
Mm-hmm.
The first 2 years are where you're acquiring the, if you will, the vocabulary or the techniques that are going to be necessary.
Right.
The last 2 years, you're really beginning to look at where are we going. I'm graduating in 2 years. What do I want to do with my life? In other words, it's very interesting that your perception seems to flip 180 degrees from being focused on yourself,
mm-hmm.
very narcissistically for those first 2 years. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the second year, you start looking out there and saying, I'm going to be out of here. What's going on out there?
Right.
And how do I deal with that?
Well, do you at USC, help yourself there, do you at USC take that person who's going to come in as a freshman and not have the vocabulary and the technique? I mean, don't you kind of have to have that before you get there?
We do some rather rigorous testing. The first thing we actually do now is we expect them to send in a video.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be audio, but now you've got to be very careful with that.
Yeah, sure.
Because
that can be faked.
Well, or fixed.
Yeah.
Okay, so they send in a video, and the video is you specify a list of two or three songs mm-hmm. or types of songs and say, you know, play. And then, based on that, you invite the finalists mm-hmm. to come out for a live performance with one of the better student rhythm sections. And they play live in front of you.
Right.
And again, we may videotape that, too.
So people have to be able to play. You don't take mm-hmm. people who don't have a certain technical proficiency and a certain repertoire, or at least familiarity, I would think.
Well, the repertoire, I mean, let's put it this way. I'm not responsible for that now,
right.
So I'm not trying to pass the buck. Mm-hmm. But the repertoire is essentially, there will be a blues form
yeah.
that you're going to have to play. There will be a easy Great American Songbook tune, mm-hmm. and there'll be something hard.
Yeah.
Perhaps a hard bop tune.
Something like Joy Spring or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, exactly. Joy yeah. Spring, which right. is demands that you get into a bunch of different keys just right. because it starts in F doesn't mean you're going to stay there very long.
Not only get in them, but get out of them too.
Yes, intelligently. Yes. And right. then not have to wipe yourself off.
Yeah, or anyone else. Yeah. yeah.
So, and out of that, then comes the live performance and you talk to them. You right. try to find out what it is. Have they got any focus? Mm-hmm. Where are they? Where do they want to do? If anything, the people who are more paranoid than the players are their parents.
You know, the reason that I brought that up is I don't want to get too specific here because I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. But you and I did a concert at a local high school about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And the band at that high school, the jazz ensemble, opened for us.
Yeah, I remember it.
And frankly, they were awful. And yeah. and I thought they were awful. And I saw the instructor afterwards, and I said, "Hey, you know, I'd love to come and like do a clinic or help your rhythm sections or anything anytime. Just call me." I gave him a card. He said, "Oh yeah. I never heard from him." I mean, these guys were playing blues scales over everything.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
And they opened up with "Girl from Ipanema," so you know, wrong. It's just like nobody was steering the ship, man. There was nothing going on. And I thought, none of these kids are going to be qualified to go anywhere that they might conceivably want to go if they're serious about this. These kids are not going to get into USC. They're mm-mm. not going to get into any jazz program. They're not going to get into Berkeley.
They won't get into Cal State Long Beach Northridge either.
Not as graduating seniors anyway. Maybe if they take a couple of years and go and study privately, they'll bone up and they'll be okay. But there's no interface there between what they're capable of doing and what they are going to be asked to do as jazz ed admitting freshmen. I mean, there's no connect there. And I was really shocked. I was shocked on two levels. I was shocked, first of all, at how they kind of didn't seem to have any command of what was going on. And I was shocked that the instructor didn't seem to think there was anything wrong with that. You know?
That's because the vast majority of people who run these kinds of bands today have no prior experience
right.
than perhaps playing that fourth trumpet, third trombone,
yeah.
third, fourth saxophone.
Right, that's who the music teacher at the high school
in
is.
In the college band that they went to, and if there was more than one, they weren't in the top band.
Yeah, he was that guy, right?
He was that person,
yeah.
or she.
Right.
And so what you wind up with is, for example, I have a friend who has an amazing band out in Palm Springs. Mm-hmm. It's called Heat Wave, and it's run by the Boys Club and Girls Club of the Chowchilla Valley, I believe.
Coachella
Valley.
Yeah.
Okay, and these kids come together from all the various high schools and junior high schools in the area because this guy understands what they need to have.
Mm-hmm.
And when this band plays, it's kind of amazing to hear them play because he had that experience. Even though he himself never played with any major bands, he knows what it's like.
Right.
And he passes that on. How do you pass on something that you've never experienced?
Well, yeah, and you and I spoke about this a couple of weeks ago in relation to a couple of other people that we know in common. The reason they're respected as teachers is because they can bring it as players, and they have the experience, and they know, the students know, that whatever this person is asking them to do, they can do it themselves,
mm-hmm.
and which is, you know, it's true of yourself also. It's that ability to be able to do that and not just talk about it, but to be able to do it, I think, is very important in an academic setting. Kids have to know, if they're kids or even adults, have to know that you can do what you're talking about, or else you're not a very good example, you know? And I think that there's a demand for that wasn't there 30 years ago, you know?
Well, it's not just with jazz, though, because
no.
I do think that music education has tended to focus on the classroom experience
mm-hmm.
and not the ensemble experience. So that very often a high school band director comes into the classroom with not all the tools that are needed to get the job done.
Right, right.
So I it's very awkward. It's a very awkward time. I do think, I think that once we get through the economic downturn that we're in right now, there's a, people are beginning to realize that musicians are people who are trained in music make better scientists, better theoreticians. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes all the way back to Albert Einstein, who was a crappy violin player, but he played violin.
Yeah, and the point is he had that in him. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's something about having to deal with just the simple fact that we talk about quarter notes and eighth notes and sixteenth notes and proportions mm-hmm. and triplets and three against two and four and all those things that are, you develop a way of expressing, triplet in three against two.
Yeah.
You begin to express that in a way that is musical, but it shows an understanding on an intellectual level that isn't necessarily measured in terms of some mathematical equation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it also allows for individuality. I mean, there is a mathematical finality to what the ultimate three against two is, but when you have a section, everybody playing three against two, there's always a little wiggle room there.
Mm.
And that's what makes it interesting to me.
Well, yeah. Interesting, good, interesting, bad.
Well, yeah, no, if there's too much room, then obviously it's not good. But the interesting part to me is the way people express, like, you know, three against two in their own individual way, the way they cut, you know, that infinitesimal little bit of time that's there that can be argued over, you know, that to me makes it interesting.
Well, you know, what it is, there's what we have people who are visual, their connection, their synapses and everything are essentially eye-based. Again, that's your classically trained musician.
Right.
We are auditorily based. So we listen to the sounds. Now, one of the things that happens, which I find very interesting, is, and very often I see this when we're playing ensembles, mm-hmm. like you're saying, I will look at a passage, and my eyes tell me it should sound a certain way, and I know it's not going to sound like that when we play it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's because the notational system doesn't capture the nuance. So we are looking at one thing and expected to play something else. And I think we all have experienced this thing as jazz musicians. You hear someone who has been brought up to essentially visually internalize things,
mm-hmm.
starting to play jazz, and their playing sounds very stilted.
Yeah.
And we're going, you know, are they improvising? Yes. But what they're doing is not connected to them auditorily.
Yeah, there's no looseness, there's no groove.
So they're you know, and that's, again, it's a very interesting question, because coming back to where jazz will be in, say, 50 years,
mm-hmm.
People who are being brought up who don't swing but do improvise, who have been brought up essentially, the closest thing to them that relates to swing would be perhaps some of the grooves that come out of smooth.
Yeah.
For these people, they're going to play, and their improvisational style is going to be closer to, again, here we are right back at the beginning of our conversation. They're closer to Miles.
Mm-hmm.
The Miles of the 60s. They're closer to that than they are to anything that precedes that. And heaven forbid, they're not living in a 12-8 world.
But Miles swung. I mean, Miles in 4-4 definitely swung.
But you don't hear Miles going do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do for very long.
No. Well, that was the point of Miles, was to not do that.
Yeah.
Not do anything that was expected of him.
But, I mean, the thing is, the kind of swing, you know, there have been all kinds of research studies into what is swing.
Yeah.
And people talk about, they say that Coltrane didn't swing. I disagree.
I disagree vehemently, yeah.
Yeah, but does he swing as much as Louis Armstrong? Let's say his swing is not as exaggerated.
And it's different. It's a different sort of thing. But I mean, swing is a lot like the famous quote about pornography. I know, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. I know it when I hear it.
It's. I hope you're planning to cut that out.
No. This is a podcast, man. Nothing gets cut
out.
Nothing gets cut out.
Okay.
You know swing when you hear it.
Oh, that's
immediately.
True.
And nobody has to analyze it. Know it. Yeah.
We know it.
Yeah.
But many of the people who play it don't know it. In other words, what they're playing that they think is swing isn't. We know because it's been there, done that.
Yeah.
They think that what they're doing is swinging like mad.
But sometimes swinging is what you don't play too. I mean, Bill Evans is a great example of that. In that you can lay out as something that somebody expects to hear and come back in at something at an unexpected time and it swings like a mother, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It swings because of what you didn't do. And that's definitely not da 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 or spang spang a lang, as our friend Jerry Redmond calls it. That ride cymbal pattern that sort of defines swing in a technical way. But swing, the word, is much bigger than that. It's much bigger than just spang, spang-a-lang. Sometimes swing is what you don't play. Sometimes swing is the absence of a definition. You know what I mean?
Well, let's say I agree with the idea that what you leave out says a lot. And when you come back in, it's where you come back in, and it's because you're thinking of this... this subdivision that has perhaps not been adequately codified in notation.
Mm-hmm.
It's strictly a result of all the things that you've heard.
Right, it's an oral art.
Yeah, yeah. And you're coming back and listening to the music, and it feels right to enter at a certain time, and that feels right is defined by your experience as a jazz musician.
Right.
I'm sure you've had experiences playing with either overseas with musicians or with overseas musicians who have come and played and you've worked with them.
Mm-hmm.
And even there, the issue of swing is somewhat unusual. Let me say this, that I think one of the things that will happen again in the next 20 to 25 years, they have to figure out a way to be able to deal with the internet as a real-time phenomenon, which they have not successfully done yet. Sound, unfortunately, doesn't move very fast.
Yeah.
Light does.
Right.
If we can find a way to transmit and convert sound into some kind of signal that can be sent to the other side of the planet, reconverted back, and the sound is not appreciably late to the point where it disturbs us, there will be musicians jamming with players from all over the world simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you say about that, because I have played both overseas and with overseas people who've come here, and I found how surprisingly cross-cultural swing is. That idea of what swings and what isn't can be pretty universal. I mean, I've played with... And you have too, I'm sure, especially with Japanese jazz players who swing their asses off, you know, who really have that same sense. And I can't necessarily speak their language or them mine, but man, you know when it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know when it's happening immediately without saying anything. And then sometimes you play with people from overseas who have a totally different idea. It's very academic and it's very studied and every note's right and it just sounds awful, you know, but the notes are right. Chords are right. The math of it is all there, but it makes no sense in terms of music you'd ever want to listen to.
Yeah, the time isn't right.
Yeah, the time's wrong, or it's subtly wrong, and it's an interesting phenomenon in itself. Obviously, they've been educated, but someone lacked. There was a lack of a governor there, a lack of someone saying, "Well, this is actually good, or this isn't good."
Well,
they stopped at "this is mathematically right" or "this is mathematically wrong." They didn't go on to what's good or bad.
All right, well, let's turn a little bit away from this just for a moment back to this issue of improvisation and language, because I think the language of jazz reached a high watermark, if you will, in the early 60s. The best of the great quintets of Miles, the musicians associated with that, the almost flood of free players that appeared in the 60s up to the early 70s, the emergence in the 70s of fusion, which, by the way, I love fusion. I have no complaints about The one thing I get annoyed with is when you listen to Al Dimeola and Stanley Clark trying to see who can play more notes.
Yeah, that's what I get bored at that.
Yeah, that because at that point it's jaw-dropping boredom.
Well, there's no emotion to me anyway. There's no emotion being conveyed, and music to me is a below the neck medium. If it's only above the neck, if it's only intellectual, if it's only about perfection and about execution, I get bored very quickly. I mean, I can admire Al Dimeola, especially as a guitar player, admire his technique tremendously. I mean, the guy knows how to play the guitar. Ooh, he knows how to work the guitar as an appliance. But I'm not getting anything from, by the way, Al, you can come on the podcast and, you know, and talk to me about, you know, what you're feeling at any time. Ooh. But I'm not getting it. I'm not getting it from John McLaughlin either. And he's a wonderful musician, but I'm not picking up on what he's transmitting somehow, because the notiness for me gets in the way. But on the other hand, you know, my roots are in Buck Owens and things like that, where it's all about direct feeling. It's a direct connection from the heart to the next heart. And I need that connection for music, or I don't feel it at all. So, you know.
Well, my question would be, would this phenomenon that we experience with Dimeola and Stanley, mm-hmm. or for that matter, a number of other musicians, is this the fault of fusion, or is it perhaps a something that was being some kind of force being exerted on these musicians, maybe by concert promoters, record companies? In other words, I'm not convinced that if fusion, if somehow could be extracted from the 20th century and put some other place, if that phenomenon wouldn't have appeared anyway. It just happened that it appeared first in fusion, and the reaction was so almost immediate and universal that players who might have started to go in that direction, in other words, pay me by the note, that they backed off before it took hold in the so-called mainstream styles of the period.
Well, I think one of the reasons, if you look at what was happening in rock and roll at the time, progressive rock, groups like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and all that, there were a lot of people playing a lot of notes in all varieties of music.
That's my point.
I think that part of it is that the audience demanded that, because the audience had become satiated with just people, with Crosby, Stills, and Nash and people like that playing really nice songs where there wasn't a lot of musical virtuosity involved, but the songs were making a connection. And then some people wanted more than that. They wanted to hear musical virtuosity, and it didn't matter whether they were jazz fans. If they were jazz fans, they listened to Return to Forever. If they were rock fans, they listened to Yes, which actually sounds pretty similar in some ways. You have a lot of notiness, a lot of fairly advanced harmonies. The rhythms are not particularly advanced, but they're very fast and very definite. You know, people just wanted to, as somebody who played in a lot of bands like that, a lot of times the audience had more money than sense, and they had more cocaine than money, and you just needed to hit them real hard to know that they were feeling anything. And I think that's part of it too. They weren't there for subtlety. You know what I mean?
Well, I agree. I want you to understand that I have, for a long time, really liked Oscar Peterson.
Me too.
But Oscar Peterson is guilty of, a lot of times, how many notes can I fit
but
in
not
per beat?
All the time. But not all the time. He could also reach back and just play a little bassy fill or something, and you'd go, oh, yeah, okay, now I know why I'm listening to Peterson.
Well, but that's my point, is that someone like Oscar had he's of that approximate period.
Yeah.
And I think if virtuosity had become a hallmark of instrumental performance in the 70s, Oscar would have slaughtered everybody because he had the facility to do it. I don't see another one who really got to where it was like annoyance was Buddy Rich.
Yeah.
I mean, astounding technical facility, and you go, I just don't want to hear that kind of thing. I mean, it's just, like I said, jaw-dropping boredom.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that there were hints of it. The Maynard, whoops, damn it, I keep hitting.
That's okay. It's okay.
There were hints of them. The Maynard Fergusons of the world, yeah, on the trumpet. It's like, okay, I'm going to reach a note in which all the dogs in the neighborhood are going into heat.
Right, but why?
Only because I can do it. Well, yeah. isn't that a virtuosity that isn't necessarily translated into number of notes per second, but it's a form nonetheless of a misplaced understanding.
Yeah, and it's nothing I want to hear. You know, the first time you hear it, go, oh, that's cool that he can do that. And especially as a failed trumpet player, I can admire that and say, well, that's, you know, okay, great, he can do that. But I don't necessarily want to hear him do it again. He's proved to me that he can hit that double high D or whatever it's going to be. I don't really need to hear that again unless there's some emotional reason to transmit that. And I don't get much. There was a rock band called 10 Years After. I don't know if you remember them or not. But it was a three-piece rock band. It was from the early 60s from England.
No.
And there was this incredible guitar player, incredibly talented technical guitar player by the name of Alvin Lee. Not to be confused with Albert Lee, who's almost the exact opposite. Great country guitar player.
Yes.
And plays with a lot of feeling. Alvin Lee was the fastest guitar player of anybody. I mean, he could outplay Wes Montgomery or Joe Pass or anybody you want in the rock setting. Loud, you know, a lot of volume, a lot of very fast 16ths, a lot of very fast triplets and all this, but in a rock setting. And I went to see him several times down at the Shrine, you know, in places like that, because if you were a guitar player, you wanted to pick up on this. But there was, for me anyway, almost no emotional content in what he was doing. It was a great guitar lesson, but there was no real reason to listen to it more than once because the emotion didn't vary. There was no emotional content that I recognized from performance to performance. It was always the same. The virtuosity was there, but there was nothing beyond that. So,
well, in a way, it reminds me of something I refer to, which I'm sure you would agree with, which is a paint by number.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you're sitting here and I've got a little book with a little file cabinet here, mm-hmm, with a whole bunch of licks.
Right.
And let's see which one. Number 74. Yeah. Okay, boom. Yeah. Okay. In fact, there's a wonderful joke.
I was thinking of the same thing. Yeah, you didn't tell it right. Yeah.
Well, that wasn't a joke. I mean, but the joke is essentially about the fact that the musicians were playing by number. And,
oh, okay.
And one of the judges finally said, my gosh, did you hear that? He played lick number 74 up a half step. That was awesome. It was like, yeah, that was the one thing that,
right,
didn't fit into the prescribed way that everyone is expected to play.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of the other joke in which people recite the jokes by the number, and after a while they're just saying the number 45,
oh,
and then nobody laughs and he didn't tell it right. Yeah,
yeah.
But these things, it's really the same thing. These things become shorthand for something, but what's lost is what originally was supposed to be there.
But now if you come back to what I said very early on, it's not just mine, but, mm-hmm, I mean the idea that you are the sum total of everything you practice, so be careful.
Yeah, yeah.
That the point is, learn the licks that intrigue you. There's something about them that got you.
Yeah.
It may be technical, or it may be just the musicality of the thing, the, mm-hmm, moment. Learn those. But if everybody learns the same vocabulary, then everybody is going to paint the same picture.
Well, only if they stop at the vocabulary. If everybody learns, because everybody kind of does learn the same vocabulary, especially these days where you've got 9,000 people teaching, you know, alto sax on the internet or guitar. Everybody learns the same vocabulary. What's important to me, and this is where it kind of comes around to can we teach jazz again? What's important to me is what happens after that. After you've taken all this stuff in, when you start regurgitating it, if you will, when you start playing it back and adding your stuff to it, that's where the self emerges, the improvisation self. That's what the difference between what you play and what Mincer plays or Shepard or something. Even if you're playing the same song, why the difference between you playing body and soul and Shepard playing body and soul is a difference we can quantify.
Because
otherwise, it's just licks, it's just notes. So there's something ineffable there that is not so easy to define, but that's why I wonder, can you teach jazz? And if so, what are you turning out at the end of it? So that's a question I really want to, if not answer, at least find your thought on. What's the end game here? What does this guy do or this girl do at the end of the 6 years? What do they then go out and do? Do they go out and teach other people Do they look for gigs? Do they? What can they do at the end of 6 years of Jazz Ed?
Well, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Everything you just identified. I mean, the things you just named.
Mm-hmm.
They can look. A successful young musician will try to have some private students.
Right.
They'll play some commercial gigs that they don't particularly like because it's necessary to pay the rent.
Right.
They'll play with the musicians that they love and hope and dream that someday that group will be able to play and record something that will have an impact on the world beyond just making a top 40 hit for a certain number of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do all those things, and they'll do it out of a love of the music and out of a love of something deep inside is important to them, and they have found a way of getting in touch with it through their playing,
mm-hmm.
and they want to get that experience. They want to share that.
Do you feel that there's a future for jazz as we know it, or will it evolve into something totally else? We'll talk a little bit about that.
It's going to be very different.
Yeah.
For one thing, it's already, we get people like Lionel Lewicki
mm-hmm.
playing click language or singing click type scats.
It's African guitar player.
Yeah, yeah. Right, from Benin.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a wonderful singer whose name I slaughter all the time. She's a Tuvan singer.
A throat singer.
Throat singer. And, then you get people who, for example, there's an actual Spanish singer, Maria Joao.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Is she a fado singer? Is she a...
She's a jazz singer.
Yeah.
But she's got so much more. There's a wonderful video of her and Bobby McFerrin in an exchange at a concert where at one point he's accompanying her and then she starts to accompany him.
Mm-hmm.
And this dialogue goes on for almost 10 minutes.
Oh.
And you look at this and you go, if you were to play that for Louis Armstrong, he would understand the concept,
mm-hmm.
but he wouldn't understand the detail.
Right, right. Yeah, but the feeling is transcendent, right?
I mean, I think so.
Yeah. What I want to link to her. What's her name again?
Maria Joao. Joao. Oh, yeah, that's definitely worth looking into.
Yeah, it will. So where are the, got to wrap up here, where are the gigs going to come from in, say, 20 years? What do you see the music business itself being? I mean, you touched a little bit on that. I mean, you have to teach, you have to do, like you said, do commercial gigs. What are the commercial gigs going to be? I mean, they're not going to be what we're looking at now.
I'm not sure of that because I have no crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I did. But I do think the musician will make the gig. I think I alluded earlier to playing a local town outdoor festival. Well, you're going to have to hustle to get the gig.
Yeah.
In other words, for example, when I was growing up, maybe when you were growing up, there was one person who was the leader of the band, and that person's job was to get us work.
Right, right.
Now we all have to get us work.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you know, if there's a church that's got a party, go talk to the minister, priest, rabbi, whatever, and say, hey, I got a bunch of musicians. We won't necessarily charge you, but I would like to be able to, when it's over, put in a plug for my whatever it is. It won't be a CD, but it'll be some kind of thing.
Or, downloads.
Yeah, that you can. In other words, you're going to have to be the contractor and the sideman.
Mm-hmm. How does education respond to this? How do you teach people that they need to do that?
Wow.
Or do you?
Well, I guess now we come back to the thing of teaching by example, that the musicians... See, we have Russ Ferranti and Bob Mincer both on our faculty. So you've got the leader of...
Yellow Jackets.
And you've also got one of the most important composing musicians in Bob Mincer.
Yeah.
The two of them working, and I'm sure they both promote each other all the time. Again, I think I have a student, we call him Guri. He's got a band called Jazz Tech. And it's a band that plays like very hip Mexican and Central American music.
That's cool.
With a much more contemporary kind of approach. It's not mariachi type things at all. And it makes me feel good to hear him doing things like that. But I think the musician has to be able to respond to the market in terms of what's out there. If I were going out, like I said, to create this magical band of myself and a guitar and bass player, I'm going to be going out and contacting, who knows, maybe restaurants where... I've had a nice meal and go to the manager of the club and saying, I'd like to bring a group in. We'll make a little noise. And, I won't necessarily, maybe if you want to give us all a free meal, that's nice. But I'm not going to go out and try and hit you up for a lot of money because he'll basically kick me out of the room.
But that demands side musicians then who are willing to go along with that. People at a certain point in their life where they're not trying to make a dollar every time they leave the house, maybe.
I'm in that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, a lot of things I do, when people call up and I don't want to work for them, my standard answer, are you listening, folks? Is, gee, I'm sorry, but I'm booked.
Yeah.
And whether it is or is not true on one level, it's true in the sense of I don't want...
Yeah.
to go out there and prostitute myself for a person I don't like on a gig that I don't want to play.
Yeah.
So that puts me, I think all of us as musicians want to be in an environment where we can make those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what you work towards. You don't want to have to be doing everything out of necessity all the time. You want to be able to inject some choice into there.
And that's when it becomes a case of you're playing truly for the fun of it.
Yeah.
Not because it, I think of some of my friends who play at places like Disneyland and I know they're doing it because it's, the benefits are good and they've got a family and and yet I feel sorry for some of them. Others I don't, because I think they have a way to get away from that and play the music that they love, and because they can do that, then in a way I kind of admire them because they're making a living as a player.
Right.
But are they making a living as a jazz player? Maybe not.
Well, maybe not, but maybe that's not that important. I mean, there are musicians who fill that niche of you need people who can execute and who can really be very organized and kind of do this sort of thing, because for entertainment, that's what people who are not musicians, civilians, that's what they want. And not every musician is going to be creative, but you and I both know people who are wonderfully talented as people who can execute, aren't particularly creative, but that's not what they're called upon to do in a theme park gig or something.
Well, not only that,
they're making people happy.
We forget the fact that for most of his life, Louis Armstrong was an entertainer who played jazz. Yeah. He was not a jazz player who entertained.
Right. That's very true.
Very true. So I don't... some of these recordings of him and the All-Stars playing, and they're astounding solo, and he's playing for 50,000 people in Montreux, and I doubt if 500 people out of those have any clue as to the magnificence of what this man just played.
Well, I mean, you got to play a lot of Hello Dolly to get to Montreux, That's the thing.
That's the thing. That's not so bad.
Yeah, that's not so bad at all. Well, anything else you want to say?
Well, this has been fun.
It has been fun. It has been fun. The reason that I wanted you specifically in here is because you express yourself real well and you've lived through all this and you've thought about this kind of stuff. But as I said to you off air when we first talked about this, everybody, almost everyone who's been in to do a show, and it may indeed be everyone, has touched on Jazz Ed in one way or another. And partially that's because we're, you know, we're all getting to an age where we're doing some teaching, mm-hmm. and people are thinking about it. And it's, I think it's an important subject, whether it's Jazz Ed or Blues Ed or Country Western Ed, doesn't matter. But I mean, this idea of musical education, of teaching people, somehow teaching people what is essentially an aural form, something that's related by actually doing it, where the academic part of it is not the most important part, but yet we have to find a place for that in academia anyway. It's an interesting thing. The dichotomies of that are interesting to me. And the idea also of preparing the next generation, I mean, this would be a whole separate episode, preparing the next generation for a business that's changing so quickly and that we may not even know how to prepare them for, you know, for the next iteration of what's going to come in the music business. That, to me, that fascinates me.
Well, I think you're right, but I would like to sum up my thoughts on this because I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I still do, yeah. and will when I walk out of here
I
today.
Hope you got to cover some of what you put in your notes.
Oh, I certainly did.
I appreciate your making notes, by the way. I really do.
Well, I feel like we have, when I touched on one thing, I said critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
If we teach how and stop teaching what, then the kids who carry our art on mm-hmm. will survive and will be successful. But if we only teach what and we stop teaching how, then the art will die.
Right.
And I have one last little quote here.
Please.
That I think summarized all of this. I was looking through a very interesting book, and a lot of jazz critics are extremely negative right now.
Yeah.
Okay. And
well, partially because they're losing their jobs because the newspapers and the other places that employ critics are not doing too well.
But I mean, for these people, I think the easiest thing to say is, "Here lies jazz, may it rest in peace." And I'll tell you something, they're full of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, people have been trying. As Kenton said, jazz was dead 50 years ago. You know. Wasn't true then either.
No, I guess not.
Yeah. Well, thank you, man. I'll see you on the bandstand.
Very good. Pleasure.
Yeah.